We took German scientists into our space program. We needed them. We utilized them. All of a sudden, after World War II, we're fighting the communists, so we need these talented Nazis to help us fight. Mm-hmm. So they came into our American intelligence community. They controlled it. Even though most of the intelligence community were all patriots and hardworking and on the right track, there was a little inner circle that had their own different agenda.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, David Banks from Veterans for Britain, and me, Tony Gosling. Abqaiq and Kurais, two Saudi oil terminals destroyed last weekend, supposedly by the Houthi rebels. In Yemen. Saudi Arabia is massacring them at the moment, but they and the Americans say it's actually the Iranians behind it. Iran threatens all-out war if it's attacked as a supposed retaliation, and all is quiet for the time being. But half Saudi Arabia's oil supplies have been cut. How long will these plants take to repair? Might we have to start buying oil, perish the thought, from Venezuela and Iran? And would the West stomach that? Also, our Superbrains series continues this week with a financial wizard you won't hear on the mass media. He used to work for Oxfam, then got a job inside the system so he could trace the roots of financial crime, which brought him to the City of London. And a million tonnes of radioactive waste is about to be dumped into the Pacific Ocean on the same week all TEPCO executives were found not guilty of ignoring safety advice, despite it being proved in court that they did ignore it. So can the Pacific Ocean cope with this massive injection of lethal poison? How come so little protest from the environmental movement? Are Japanese courts as independent as British courts, or are they controlled too? Sister show Dialects here on BCFM next Tuesday at noon. This week, former punk rock guitarist James Adlington and founder of Bristol Blue Glass in the late 1980s. Much to the ire of the Bristol's merchant venturers. James takes us through the history of glassmaking in our city and the brilliant bit of marketing which turned it for Isaac Jacobs into one of the most lucrative fads of the 17th century, Bristol Blue Glass. Even my parents had some when we were kids and we didn't know why it had been such a fad. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday. I'll download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk and find out how to blow glass too. But we start this week, Martin, with the attack in Saudi Arabia, one of the most devastating yet, by the Houthi rebels, using probably Iranian-built drones, but that doesn't mean to say necessarily the Iranians did it, does it?
It doesn't. I mean, obviously, when these incidents happen, everybody's blaming, you know, there's various narratives being generated about who did it and for what purposes. The Houthi rebels claimed it. They had one of their generals, you know, with full uniform saying that, because of course the Yemeni army split, they have got some fairly sophisticated kit. Some of it may have come from Iran indirectly, but it's definitely the Houthis in my mind who've done it. And of course they've been attacking Saudi targets for quite a while, because they themselves are under heavy bombardment. Yemen is.
But the Saudis are saying that this attack came down from the north.
Drones can come in from any direction. It doesn't mean anything, does it?
Well, it does. It means that those Houthi rebels may have been sitting in an airbase up in the northwest of Iran.
No, there's another suggestion by the Israelis and by others is that it was actually Iraqi Shia militias based around Basra, the people that beat the British army, if you remember, a few years ago and then took over there. But in actual fact, the But there's a very interesting comment by Pepe Escobar, if people know who he is, in Asia Times this week, is saying that the Houthis may... Don't forget, you've got a big Shia population. It's actually the main... they are the main workforce in the oil industry in Saudi Arabia. Rich Sunnis do not work in the oil industry. The actual grunts are Shia workers, and therefore they would possibly be easily cooperating. I mean, that's what the Yemeni general said. We were cooperating with good people inside Saudi Arabia to carry out this attack. And they've also carried out attacks on various airports and so on. So, and of course, what they're trying to do, since their country's been invaded by Saudi Arabia, is to take the war to the Saudis, which is what you'd do if you wanted to win.
Anyway, the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo hot-footed it in one of their planes over to Saudi Arabia to commiserate with the Saudis and also to ask questions about, you know, is this going to threaten oil supplies and to gather intelligence. So here's a little compilation of various bits of interviews with him and with related to this attack last weekend, on which has now cut off half of the Saudi oil supply, apparently.
I was sent here to work to make sure that I understood how our friends and allies here in the region were viewing the challenge and the threats posed by the Islamic Republic of Iran. I certainly accomplished that, and I think I'll be able to give the President some important information about how it is we should think about proceeding.
Mr. Secretary, did you gather any new evidence that shows who was behind the attacks, and do you think you have a slam dunk case to bring to the UN next week?
I think it's abundantly clear, and there is an enormous consensus in the region that we know precisely who conducted these attacks was Iran. I didn't hear anybody in the region who doubted that for a single moment.
Given Zarif's comments today about an act of all-out war, does that change the calculation, and do you think there's an opportunity for some sort of peaceful resolution to this?
Certainly that's what President Trump, it's what America always wants. We'd like a peaceful resolution deed. I think we've demonstrated that. They've taken down an American UAVs, conducted the largest attack on the globe's energy in awfully long time, and we are still striving to build out a coalition. I was here in an active diplomacy while the foreign minister of Iran is threatening all-out war to fight to the last American. We're here to build out a coalition aimed at achieving peace and a peaceful resolution to this. That's my mission set. It's what President Trump certainly wants me to work to achieve. And I hope that the Islamic Republic of Iran sees it the same way.
But as he heads back to Washington, it is still not clear what action will be taken.
The problem, of course, with blaming the Iranians so explicitly is that the two sides are compelling themselves to respond, and yet neither the Americans nor the Saudis have any desire to go to war with Iran.
Damage in the facilities.
Iran continues to deny any involvement in the weekend attacks despite all this wreckage of Iranian weapons, which the Saudis say proves their culpability. Iran doesn't want a military escalation either, but the foreign minister said today all-out war will be the consequence of any US strike on its country. Old habits die hard, Foreign Minister Zarif tweeted to Mr. Pompeo. He included an old video in which the former CIA director brags about lying and cheating.
At West Point, you will not lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate those who do. I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It's like we had entire training courses.
Company that they want to make.
Across the region now, though, there is genuine consensus that these latest attacks do demonstrate more aggression by Iran that must be countered.
It's always been this the way. I mean, even with the Houthis, even with the Iraq, even with Syria, we always go back to Iran and we say this is the militia. Hezbollah is a militia by Iran in Lebanon. In Syria, there's also militias. In Iraq, there's almost 44 militias and the Houthis. So we always point into Iran.
Well, the Iranians being blamed in most of that report, but the question is, was it really them? The latest from Kurais, which is the giant oil field which was attacked, is actually I've found on Zero Hedge. Which this is the most recent, Martin. The crippling damage to Saudi Arabia's facilities, Aramco, in the aerial attack were blamed on the Iranian sponsorship by the US and the Saudis. A mess of oil melted to asphalt, twisted and charred metal grates. And there's some pictures here on the Bloomberg report, as well as this Zero Hedge report. I'll put a link up to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. As for the oil supplies, Aramco has remained insistent that the field will return to pre-attack output levels this month, after the company reported losing half its daily output in the aftermath of the early Saturday attacks, impacting a whopping 5% of global oil supply. Bloomberg's says Kuraeus has a capacity of 1.45 million barrels a day, processing all its oil on site. However, the attack took out four 300-foot towers essential to the production process. So they're putting a positive spin on it. They're saying by the end of the month we'll be back up to full production.
Well, what the Yemeni army is saying, that's just for starters. So you know, that's what they're saying. We can do this and we can do it again.
Do you think it will persuade the Saudis to stop attacking the Houthis in Yemen?
Well, I presume that's the calculation made by the Yemeni military leadership, and there's no reason why they should just sit there and soak it up if they can make it hurt the Saudis. Of course, they haven't killed anybody here. They've just wrecked their economy, hopefully, from their point of view. And, you know, they would say, well, that's what armies are there for, to defend our country.
It's interesting, at the same time, we've had the elections in Israel. Do you think the Israelis are in any way related to this conflict?
Well, of course they are. They're the Israelis and the Saudis are allies against Iran, so they coordinate very closely with each other. There are Israeli military personnel inside Yemen fighting with the Saudis, and of course there are British military personnel, as these guys from the Special Boat Squadron were wounded not that long ago. But of course, there's been no debate in Parliament about whether we should be involved in this conflict, but clearly we are. And of course, a lot of weaponry, some of it produced in Bristol, is being used by the Saudi armed forces to kill civilians in Yemen.
So David Banks is still with us from Veterans for Britain. They're saying, David, the Saudis have counted a total of 25 drones and missiles used in the twin attacks, after statements by Yemen's Houthi rebels say only 10 drones were used. So it does seem like there's a little bit of information deficit, or maybe we could just call that lying. What do you make of this attack?
Well, I lived in the United Arab Emirates for a few years, and there's one thing that I learnt there to do with these ructions, and that, well, it's more than ructions, you know, it's tragedies and conflict. It's to not trust the first thing that comes out, or to never make assumptions about what you perceive to be the reality. So with that in mind, you know, not you know, being thousands of miles away, not having access to the full scope of information, I wouldn't have a clue. And the other thing I'd say, though, that might be pertinent is that one thing that might be under consideration by Western countries about this is that to be able to launch a drone, a military drone at all, in a useful way, takes a level of sophistication. To be able to launch it in a way that delivers force and weaponry requires a certain level of extra sophistication, so that might be why they're putting blame in certain areas. But who knows, I don't know.
Well, I mean, the pictures are pretty clear. Half of the Saudi Arabian oil production was affected, which could make a big difference, couldn't it?
Definitely. Well, make an impact.
But the context of this is this 3.5-year war now, which some people say has killed 100,000 people. Certainly most of those, something like 85-90%, have been civilians in Yemen. So that you can't really look at this attack that happened on Saturday without putting that in context.
Well, yeah, conflicts have reciprocal actions. What can you say? It's
Well, I mean, one of the things you said just now was that it takes quite a lot of sophistication to do an attack like this. I mean, one might wonder that the Houthis have taken several years to get this level of skill. And in a way, what's going on here is the British and the Americans are supplying to Saudi Arabia aircraft and munitions to kill Yemenis. And now what's happening is the Iranians seem to be supplying the equipment. Obviously, the Iranians can't go to the arms fair last week that was in Docklands and buy a load of drones to use to attack Saudi Arabia. They simply won't sell them to the Iranians. To the Houthis, but the Iranians will. So they've decided, well, we're going to buy some drones, we're going to get a few missiles, and we're going to cut their oil supply, which is like their jugular vein. But amazingly, as Martin said, it doesn't look like anyone was actually killed in this, but it's had an enormous impact.
Yeah, if anyone was killed, I don't want to start making stuff up, but...
Well, that's what the Saudis have said. Again, you're right. You know, they may be lying about that, but...
There might be propaganda gain in not acknowledging that. It might cut the other way as well. But what's quite interesting in discussing this, taking sort of wider viewpoint, is to ask the question, at what stage does selling a weapon to another state and for them to have control over what is happening to it or how it's used, at what stage does that become a proxy war? If the Iranians sold weapons to the Yemenis, if Britain sold weapons to Saudi Arabia, is it really sort of puppeteering? I think it's... I've just put it forward as a question because it... The UK would not claim to be acting as the instigator in the way that the West is claiming Iran to be the instigator. It's a question.
The UK has, though, apologised apparently for accidentally supplying weapons to Saudi Arabia. Martin,
well, I don't think they've apologised. Have they? Their campaign for the arms trade took them to court, and there was a question about whether they'd broken their own guidelines in selling stuff to the Saudis. But as I say, British military personnel were wounded inside Yemen, special boat squadron people, not long ago. It was in the Daily Express, and they presumably got that from the people in the SBS.
Because a court ruling earlier this year barred the UK government from selling arms to Saudi Arabia that could be used in Yemen. The UK has apologised now for selling licences for military equipment to Saudi Arabia in contravention of that court ruling, which was banning arms sales to the kingdom that could be used in the war on Yemen. International Trade Secretary Liz Truss admitted the two licences had been granted to equipment that could be used in Yemen, but claimed the sales had been made in error.
Well, I mean, the campaign against the arms trade are obviously doing their best to try and throw sand in the works.
Liz Truss is not doing her best to obey the law, is she?
Well, no, I mean, that's her job is to do what she's supposed to do politically and all the rest of it. Whether she's obeying the law or not, campaign for the arms trade are going to take them to court and all the rest of it.
With the risk of returning to discuss Brexit, David, don't you think that this sort of entanglement that the British have got themselves into, being desperate to sell weapons, selling them to Saudi Arabia, getting involved in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, potentially, and most of them civilians, this is the sort of thing we're going to be seeing more of, because this is a British and a US entanglement rather than a British and an EU entanglement?
I would take the opposite view. I think although we have been taken into some misadventures as a country, at least if our democracy and our democratic decisions were closer to the voter, then we'd be able to see some remedy to things that, as a nation, we don't particularly like. I think that taking the democratic course of action, rather than this aggregated viewpoint instructed by a technocracy in Brussels, is a better way to make decisions on what we do with our arms business and international relations.
Anyway, the latest, it seems that the Saudi-led coalition is striking Yemen's Hodeidah in the wake of the refinery attacks claimed by the Houthis. So the Saudi-led coalition has launched a military operation north of Hodeidah, the crucial port city where nearly all of Yemen's scarce food and other supplies are delivered, against what it called legitimate military targets. State-run Ekebriya TV reported on Friday, that's in Saudi, the coalition put out a call to civilians to keep clear of the operational targets, even though it's unclear how much of the Yemeni population, 80% of which are in various states of humanitarian crisis after more than 5 years of bombardment, would watch Saudi TV to know what sites to stay away from. The operation comes on the heels of the major attack on Saudi Arabia's largest oil processing plants. Martin, this does suggest that the Saudis think that it's the Yemenis, not... they're actually taking action in Yemen against the Houthis.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's been ongoing for quite a while.
This is apparently a reaction to
Yes, it may be a reaction as well. I mean, I think what Pepe Escobar was suggesting, that because you've got a large Shia population who are basically the workforce in the Saudi oil industry, that sabotage of that industry is pretty straightforward for the Houthis, because and the Yemeni general that gave his press conference said, well, we're working with people inside Saudi Arabia, and presumably he was hinting that they're working with the Shia, who are basically the majority population in the east part of Saudi Arabia, where all the oil is. And of course, Saudi Arabia was only created by the British in the 1920s, and the Al Saud family were put in charge of it, but it's not a real state. It's actually a glass pillar which could easily shatter, because it's got no legitimacy. And it's quite possible at some point, what Pepe Escobar was suggesting, possibly tongue-in-cheek, is that Nasrullah and the Yemeni army could just seize Mecca and Medina and call for an uprising in the eastern provinces where all the oil is, and we could have a redrawing of the boundaries. You know, Yemen is far more populous than Saudi Arabia. It's always been the part of Arabia where most people lived. And Saudi Arabia is basically the desert, and some of the tribes that used to live in the desert who were put in power by the British at the end of World War I, and therefore, you know, a very vulnerable state.
The British, I mean, I'm assuming that you think that this attack by Saudi Arabia, which has been going on 5 years now against Yemen, should be ended, David. How do we stop such conflicts? Can we stop such conflicts?
I think...
Is it part of our job?
Pardon?
Is it part of our job, or should we just stay well clear? Because the thing is, we're making money out of this, aren't we?
Well, I think it is part of the remit of the British people and our representatives to be interested in justice around the world. Do we intervene, or do we go the United Nations? Where's the UN and all this?
I mean, the other thing, of course, is that Yemen was actually a British part of the British Empire for a while. I think it was in the 1960s. We had a little bit of a fight there, and eventually we said, well, actually, look, guys, you know, you can have it. And I think there was something like 100 people killed, almost all of whom were combatants. The big difference now is we're talking about tens of thousands of people being killed, almost all civilians. So is there anything we can do?
I think more's got to be done. I think that there needs to be a level of political discourse and intervention which doesn't just get skewed by the weight of finance that's on one side of the equation. I think that there might be a tendency of the West to do that. However, there are, injustices and atrocities going on, which also need to be addressed. But what can we do thousands of miles away? We can ask our political leaders to make noises at the United Nations, but I think beyond that, it's not really in our scope.
Well, we could arrest Liz Truss and put her in jail for making things worse and disobeying the law that said that you mustn't be selling any arms that could be used in Yemen. But anyway, Martin, in the background to all of this, of course, we've got the Israeli elections. Latest are that Gantz has rejected an offer of a coalition or some sort of electoral pact with Netanyahu this week. They had elections on Tuesday. The outcome could possibly... I mean, he's clinging to power, basically, Netanyahu, but he's going to have to be making another coalition. It seems that every few months now they have another election in Israel, and it's equally as unconclusive as the previous one.
Well, they've got a very, very extreme version of proportional representation, which means you've got very great fragmentation in the political system there. And of course, and you've got some Palestinians who are Israeli citizens who do vote, but no Israeli parties will form any coalitions with them. They make up about a fifth of the Knesset. And of course, the big elephant in the room is that the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank and all the rest of it don't get any vote in any of this at all, even though it is their country, because it was conquered by the British again during the same period at the end of the First World War. And we decided to bring in the Balfour Declaration and create a Jewish homeland, even though the locals didn't want anything like that at all, and we're still living with the consequences.
So President Trump, David, has distanced himself. It's seen as a Middle East monitor, saying, well, this could be a snub to Netanyahu. He said, my relationship is not with you, Netanyahu, it's with Israel. So Netanyahu and Trump, what do you make of the British relationship and the US relationship with Israel at the moment, and particularly with regard to the Palestinians?
Well, the UK's view towards the US-Israel relationship, you mean?
Yeah. And our relationship with Israel. I mean, it's a tripartite thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
The British are seen by some countries as the craziest country on the planet for creating, first of all, the United States of America and then Israel, the two countries that seem to cause more trouble than any other country on the planet. Mm. Although some might say it's Iran causing all the trouble, China causing all the trouble. Actually, the US and Israel seem to be the instigators of quite a lot, and particularly with this nation state law in Israel now making it effectively an apartheid state. Anyway, what do you make of Netanyahu? Do you think he'll manage to stay in power, and if he does, is that a good or a bad thing?
I'm completely adrift on this topic, to be honest. I don't pay a lot of attention towards Netanyahu in all honesty.
Okay.
Simply because for the last 3 years my focus has been Brussels, and I think if I were to sort of comment on Israel, I might be sort of overstepping sort of certain.
Okay, fair enough. Martin, what about Trump? He seems to be, like I said, distancing himself a little bit from Netanyahu. I suppose that's just a fairly sensible thing to do, isn't it? Not knowing who's going to be taking over.
That's right. I mean, he doesn't want to get... If Netanyahu goes down and possibly goes to prison because he's got corruption charges against him, Trump doesn't want to be dragged down with him. But, I mean, the situation is very, very acute. There's a possibility, not because it's quite clear that the Pentagon and the Iranian military do not want to fight each other, but just as in the run-up to the First World War, just one miscalculation by either side could easily create a conflagration. And of course, there are forces at work in Israel in particular who want to see... I mean, Netanyahu has been pretty clear all along, we want a war with Iran. That's what they want. It's a question is, do the American people want that? And the question for us is, do the British people want that? And do we want to be involved in it? And
anyway,
that's quite an important question we're facing.
I thought we'd have a musical break in a minute. But before we do that, the other major story this week is that the executives of which I haven't seen enough coverage of and enough campaigning around this whole issue by environmentalists, is the threat by Japan that they will be dumping radioactive water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean, sparking serious safety concerns. Diplomats from 22 countries have attended the briefing at the foreign ministry in Japan. Fukushima's operator said it would run out of storage space for the water, and that it's been deciding what to do with the tritium-riddled water for 8 years. I don't know if it's possible to evaporate the water so that the tritium is just left there rather than pouring it into the ocean, but it certainly doesn't sound like a great solution with this disaster. And also we've had this week, David, we've had these executives from TEPCO released. This is a disaster. I think it was 8 years ago it took place, and it's a bit like one of those things like Three Mile Island. It's now in our consciousness as a total disaster. The fact was that TEPCO, the operators of this nuclear plant, Fukushima, just simply didn't prepare for a tsunami at all.
They should have done, of course. I was working in public relations in the insurance industry at the time, and one of the things that came about from the tsunami was that there were whole families wiped out, and therefore nobody left to claim life insurance policies, which were taken out through Japanese companies in London. The sheer scale of this. And
so
its
what
impact.
Happens? Sorry, but what happens in that situation if a life insurance policy comes due because the person has died and there's nobody to claim it? I mean, what happens?
At the time, people were talking about the companies just basically pocketing the cash. But I am not aware of what happened subsequently. There might have been a resolution between the London Market. And
we're getting into the seamy underbelly of a disaster like this. Mm. Another thing which we heard about this week, I don't know, I can't remember where I heard about it, was that there were a whole load of elderly people in old people's homes that just got abandoned and just died slowly over a period of several days because nobody was there to care for them. Martin, you know, this seems to me as if it may have been all this bad news about Fukushima is just coming out at the time where we've got this Rugby World Cup, and hopefully it'll be lost in the clamour and the clapping of rugby over in Japan.
Well, I think the Japanese state is instinctively secretive. So, I mean, one of the things that was very admirable, as you could see, the response of the population to this terrible tragedy was extremely orderly. Yeah, it's one of the things that people admire about the Japanese. You know, they don't panic. They do queue up in an orderly fashion.
Well, orderly march. Hang on, orderly marching out of an old people's home and just abandoning all these old people.
I'm just saying, in general, what would happen here if something like that happened? When New York went through a in the 1970s, when the lights went off because the generators had failed, people went out and robbed all the shops and killed everybody and stole everything in sight. You didn't see that in Japan because it's a very orderly culture. And, you know, obviously that's just an outside impression. It can also be, you know, as we all know, there's a very dark side to Japanese history. You know, the obedience to authority and all the rest of it, the Burma Railway and all of that.
But, anyway,
it's a very, very dangerous and difficult situation.
I think things in the world are holding up, so I think maybe we could do with a little bit of light-hearted music on the show. So I thought we'd start this week with something which is a kind of reaction to this whole idea of the European Empire, which Guy Verhofstadt was talking about. Let's have an EU Empire. The only thing is, no one actually voted for it.
Let me clarify the meaning of the expression. He is a liberal. The enemy, meaning the one-world conspirators, have seized upon that word liberal as a cover-up for their activities. It sounds so innocent and so humanitarian to be liberal.
love me, I'm a liberal. Love me, I'm a liberal. Love me, I'm a liberal.
That's from 1993. It's Chumbawamba. Love Me, I'm a Liberal, from their Anarchy album. Actually, that was recorded just a year before it actually came out, that album. But we don't hear enough of Chumbawamba, do we? What happened to them? Damn But No Bacon and the rest of them from Yorkshire. Fantastic little bunch. But I'm joined in the studio by David Banks from Veterans for Britain. David, I know you're a naval reservist at the moment. You've done PR in various places, including the Middle East. What's going to happen with this transition period? If Boris Johnson gets his deal, gets rid of the backstop, and they have something else, the front stop or whatever, something similar, how long is this transition period going to last, and what will it mean for us?
Well, our thinking at the moment is that it would resemble the transition that's in May's deal, and it would end at the end of next year. And the problem with that, for just the defence topic, is that it would allow for the EU to crunch forward with integration, including the UK, in structures that we've joined since we voted to leave. And that in itself would be damaging enough, because it's things like financial supervision over the Ministry of Defence, tying UK companies into grant-funded schemes that are underpinned by EU rules and require the UK to stay in them. But in addition to that, we have the regular run-of-the-mill operation of MOD contracts, which are done under EU rules, which are simply not useful to the UK and UK shipbuilding. For instance, shipbuilding, among other things. And I can give you an example of that. Something that we've been looking at quite closely recently is the replacement of the support ships for the aircraft carriers. And these ships are large £1 billion ships. They're called Fleet Solid Support. And if they were to be built in the UK, as they've usually been in the past, if you go back 10 plus years, then they were always built in the UK, then it would support thousands of jobs. It would be major investment into otherwise somewhat deprived communities, you know, the northwest, northeast, the Clyde, and elsewhere. What EU rules say is that the MOD cannot keep these contracts in the UK in a UK-wide contract competition. The UK government has to go international on these contracts, and what that means is that companies like Navantia in Spain, which get very cozy subsidies and assistance from their government, are in pole position to get these contracts because they're able to offer prices that are just completely unrealistic. I've been to several committee hearings in Parliament about this, and they just can't get their heads around the subject because they don't know the rules. And you have MPs saying, oh, well, let's give it to the UK shipyards and we can claim that this is best value for money for the UK taxpayer, and that's what the directive is all about. So, and we'll show the EU Commission that we're investing in local communities. It's specifically banned for the UK government to take investment in local communities as a consideration in the contract award. It has to be purely done on lowest price. So here's the alternative. If the UK were to leave clean on the 31st of October, the next day the UK government could say, OK, we're going to freeze those contracts and we're going to reissue them on UK only, which we're allowed to do outside of the EU, under WTO rules. It's something called the Government Procurement Agreement, which most of our non-EU allies and friends and the G7 and G20 countries are in.
Now, Martin, what David's implying there is actually completely opposite of what Jeremy Corbyn's been saying, that leaving the EU with no deal could be good for jobs.
Shipbuilding is important, but it's not major. The car industry is a far bigger employer than the shipbuilding industry in this country. And, of course, you've got to look at being in a thing like the EU. It's not just about defence, as I'm sure David will accept. And, of course, from my point of view, none of this is actually market production.
But the defence side of it hasn't really been looked at, has it? And you've got a very massive implication of this European Defence Union, and it's a good idea, I would say, suggest people don't use Google. I mean, you know, but anyway, look up the European Defence Union, because it ultimately would mean that British soldiers could be ordered in to a conflict by a French or a German general. And that is one of the things that the British forces don't want.
Well, when we went to war in Iraq in 2003, Tony, in the United Nations Security Council, both the Germans and the French and every Commonwealth country apart from Australia opposed our position. But we went along with what the Americans wanted us to do, as we've done since 1945.
Isn't that the main problem, David?
Because in actual fact, we're not...
Martin, isn't that the main problem, David, that this is where we're going? We're going to be part of an American empire rather than an EU empire.
No, it isn't. To repeat the commonly trodden phrase, we're going to be taking back control, and so democratic decisions will rule the roost over matters of UK deployment. Unless we make the mistake of putting another Blair in charge, who was put there for other reasons than to go and wage war in the Middle East, but he seemed obsessed with doing that anyway.
So what would you make of... Martin, you probably agree with David about Blair there.
I think we've got common ground about that. I think the problem is that we've been integrated into NATO's intelligence structures and military structures since World War II. And, of course, the Americans, basically, we didn't fight in Vietnam because the Labour government here said we're not going to get involved in that. Australia and New Zealand, they sent their people, and, of course, they got involved and some of them died. And, of course, they had to take the responsibility for fighting a war that they lost in which millions of people died. We escaped from that, although there was an attempt by the British military to overthrow Wilson, the attempt at the seizure of Heathrow Airport and so on. Basically, the people that run this country are not based in Brussels, apart from the NATO headquarters at Shape.
We heard from David Davis, Steve Baker and Suella Braverman in the first hour about the civil service obstructing Brexit whilst May was in charge. Is there any evidence, David, that the Ministry of Defence have been obstructing Brexit? Because that's another department, isn't it? And what's their attitude, the civil servants? Because they're supposed to be impartial. Have they been?
Well, this is a really key question in my last 2 or 3 years of work. And it hasn't been the Ministry of Defence. It's principally been the Foreign Office and the Cabinet Office. And two teams within those departments, very small numbers of officials who have been perpetrating what we call a sellout in defence. The Ministry of Defence's actions have been merely to rubber stamp what they're told to say by the Foreign Office and Cabinet Office. If there had been more involvement from senior officers, from the Secretary of State, from senior officials at the Ministry of Defence, I think that the level of attachment in defence that would come from May's deal or a reinvention of it without the backstop would simply have been stopped, nipped in the bud.
What's going to happen on the 31st of October?
I think we'll leave without the EU's deal. I think we'll have some kind of a deal brokered with the World Trade Organization, and we'll cooperate with the EU just as we do with any other state around the world, and that's what the EU is becoming. It's becoming a state, because that's the whole aim of the project.
Martin, what do you think is going to happen on 31st of October?
Well, the Supreme Court are now deciding what's about the prorogation. It's already, the Parliament have already passed the law saying that if he hasn't got a deal, he's got to ask for an extension. There's a question of whether the EU will give an extension. I think the real negotiation is between the Irish government and the British government, just as it was over the Good Friday Agreement, and that ultimately will have to be resolved.
So what's going to happen? Come on.
I think we're not going to leave on the 31st, but I think that ultimately we may, with no deal or deal.
So another extension.
But not on the 31st.
Okay. Well, I did say we'd do Super Brains again this week, and he's one of my favourites. We've had him on this show, actually. His name's John Christensen. He's from the Tax Justice Network, and you will never hear more than about 5 seconds of him on anywhere on the mainstream press. And here he is. He's talking about the fact, really, that the City of London rules both the press and our government. And that's what the conclusion he came to after working both for Oxfam and inside the financial system.
What we've discovered is a fascinating trail of British government officials raising the alarm bells at every possible opportunity. Here's one, a Colonial Office official sitting in the Bahamas saying, in very civil service speak, "We are deeply concerned by the financial wizards that are working here out of the Bahamas. We see similar things happening in Bermuda, but it is quite clear that these people are getting up to all sorts of shenanigans, not only to break Sterling's exchange control things, but all sorts of other illegal market rigging activities." Of course, at that stage, the Bahamas and Bermuda and most of these places had no regulation whatsoever. By the way, this is a Sunday Times article which we dug up, dated 23rd February 1969. What's fascinating about this article was it was actually pinned, the only newspaper article pinned in a Treasury report, and it was quite clear it was pinned there to alert us to the fact that there was pressure coming from the City of London to turn the City of London into a tax haven. And here it is, laid out by the then financial editor of the Sunday Times, saying what we now need to do as our development strategy is to largely deregulate large areas of activity of the City of London and give them a whole host of tax advantages to encourage capital into Britain. From a secret Bank of England report, which was declassified earlier this year, our feeling now is that the potential gaps in the exchange control hedge can no longer be contained by occasional visits. In other words, they were flagging up the Bank of England's exchange control thing was collapsing as a result of activities out there. The smaller, less sophisticated and remote islands are receiving almost constant attention and blandishments from expatriate operators who aspire to turn them into their own private empire, which is exactly what happened in a place called British Honduras, now called Belize, now the private empire of a certain financier of the Conservative Party, whose name we cannot mention for fear of libel suits. We can't mention Lord Ashcroft, can we? But one of the things that fascinated me about this particular memorandum was this quote. "We need, therefore, to be quite sure that the possible proliferation of trust companies, banks, etc., which in most cases would be no more than brass plates manipulating assets outside the islands, does not get out of hand." Now, of course, there they're saying, they're admitting that, of course, nothing actually happens in the islands. It all happens out of London. These are basically offshore satellites of London. It is London that does all the activity, using these places to operate outside the regulatory controls of the Bank of England. But then it's the next line that I love. "There is, of course, no objection to their providing bolt holes for non-residents." In other words, anyone outside the Sterling area can get up to doing whatever the hell they want. We don't mind if this wrecks Latin America, or indeed the dollar area, or our continental cousins. And then getting back to the Financial Secrecy Index, which we published, here are the 60 jurisdictions that we have mapped out. And you'll see that a lot of them are the small islands in the sun that you think of when you think of tax havens and all the little places up in the Swiss Alps. But there are some big players there as well. The United States, United Kingdom, Switzerland, Netherlands, Luxembourg. But exactly one half, and they're the one half that are flagged up there, highlighted in yellow, exactly one half of those 60, 30 out of 60, are very closely politically linked to Britain, either because they're overseas territories, or because they're crown dependencies, or because they're members of the Commonwealth, the former British Empire. And I'm being kind because you'll notice, for example, that Hong Kong, it's not flagged up there, even though Hong Kong is very largely a creation of the City of London, sitting offshore. Likewise, Ireland, would you believe? Another, Dublin is essentially an offshoot of the City of London in the way it operates. So this is very, very deeply embedded in our development model. These places act as conduits for capital from the rest of the world headed towards the City of London. Ask any anti-money laundering specialist and they will agree that London is the final destination of choice for all criminal money. That's where it wants to end up because of the secrecy that London offers. It is the final destination where you can mix your money into the mainstream financial markets. This is Eva Joly, the head of the Development Committee of the European Parliament. Close colleague and friend of mine. She's a French examination magistrate. She's originally Norwegian, and she has for a long time headed the Norwegian anti-corruption unit, which is one of our main sponsors. She has very publicly said the City of London, that state within a state, which has never transmitted even the smallest piece of usable evidence to a foreign magistrate. When I talk with Eva, she says that she regards London as the least cooperative jurisdiction in the world. And this is very much my experience. Getting back to the archives, this from 1971. A bit of background to this particular report. Inland Revenue recognised that they were losing tens of millions of revenue in the 1960s. In the 1960s, for those of you with long memories, a million actually meant something. So to lose tens of millions of the government budget was a very significant sum. They were anxious to claw it back. They called in the UK Treasury and said, will someone please cooperate to help us tackle this problem of tax evasion through the British Overseas Territories? UK Treasury, to begin with, wasn't particularly cooperative. The Foreign and Commonwealth Office was purposefully uncooperative, saying, we don't want to pick up the tab for our former colonies. Worse still, the Ministry of Overseas Development said, actually, it's a development strategy for them, and they're helping London as well. So the Overseas Development Ministry at that time was saying, we want to support the tax haven economy because it means we don't have to pay, they won't be dependent upon our aid. But look at what is kind of highlighted here. And this kind of nails the lie that actually it was the US administration that was pushing this process. Quite the opposite. The US administration was pushing in exactly the opposite way. They were very anti United Kingdom's development strategy of deregulating financial capitalism and using tax havens to attract capital out of the south. Also France, which had, and this is a word I'm not particularly conversant with, animadverted on the prevalence of paradis fiscaux as yet another undesirable feature of the sterling area. That was in 1971. So this has a long history of Britain working against the interests of our so-called OECD allies and working against their agenda. This report was published, well, it wasn't published, this report was completed in 1971, never saw the light of day, was never acted upon, but the Treasury said in this report, we must urgently act against tax havens and against deregulation of the City of London because it will eventually lead to disastrous crisis within the financial system. That's how far back this goes. They were flagging it up. Shift away to what I discovered when I set out to start exploring this. And I came into this from working with Oxfam, and I was working with Oxfam actually on microcredit and cooperatives. And I was working in, of all places, Malaysia, on preparing a law draftsman's brief to prepare a new cooperative development law to encourage the growth of microcredit and credit unions in Malaysia, because they were still using the old colonial model. And whilst I was working there, some of my co-researchers at the Ministry of Rural Development came to me and said, look, there is a major, major problem within the cooperative sector. It's a political problem. And what's happened is that we have allowed the creation of what are called deposit-taking cooperatives. And I said, hello, what's that? Well, it's not really a cooperative. It's an open-ended unit trust. In other words, an investment vehicle taking deposits from widows and orphans and all the rest, from the general public, in other words. But it's operating through the cooperative system because it's, by doing this, it can be totally unregulated. Most of these have been set up with very close ties to political parties, and therefore no one is doing anything about it. But we know that massive fraud is happening. Now, for reasons which escape me now, I decided we'd look into this. And I spoke to the central bank there, and I spoke to others, I spoke to the registrar of cooperatives, and they all said, look, we know this is happening. We know we're concerned about it, but there's nothing we can do about it. And we don't want to touch it because it's got high-level political connections involved, so it's very political. The more we investigated, the clearer it was that massive funds were disappearing. In fact, when eventually the whole crisis blew up, and it blew up as a result of this newspaper article which I had published in the Business Times, that is Southeast Asia Business Times, when it blew up, Ernst & Young were called in to do the audit, and they reckoned that somewhere between $700 to $800 billion had disappeared. After the publication of that article in the Business Times, there was a massive run and a banking collapse. And this from the Financial Times, I don't expect you to read the whole damn lot, but you will see 24 of those deposit-taking cooperatives simply collapsed. It was a major systemic crisis. That's all incidental, because this is what triggered off my interest in capital flights and illicit financial movements out of developing countries. I decided to follow some of those money, and it took me to Singapore, to Brunei, to Hong Kong, and then it took me home to Jersey. I'm a Jerseyman. And I met a wall of total uncooperation, in fact, deliberate attempts to prevent any investigation into this, even though it was clear a massive fraud had happened. The lawyers behind the offshore companies, the lawyers behind the offshore trusts, the regulators in Jersey quite simply put stone walls up at every single stage, even when Interpol got involved. So I decided that, and that's really what precipitated my move back to Sudan. It wasn't that I was working inside the system and got disillusioned. I decided that I had to go into the system to find out how it worked. So I got a job there, and what I found from working on the inside and having access to client files, hundreds of client files through Deloitte & Touche, and quietly working away there with complete access to all of them, was systemic insider trading, systemic market rigging, endless avoiding disclosures of conflicts of interest, a lot of illicit arms trading, illicit political donations, contract kickbacks, bribery, fraudulent invoicing, trade mispricing and tax evasion. This is what happens when you allow financial markets to become totally secretive. You create what sociologists call a criminogenic environment.
That's John Christensen from Tax Justice Network, one of our super brains. Martin, I'm quite enjoying our super brains series. These are the people who we just never hear in the mainstream press. And there he is explaining all these different types of criminal activity that are now going on with the help of the City of London. This is all due to deregulation.
Well, yes. And, I hate to bring Brexit up again, but not everybody, but a lot of pro-Brexit people are keen on the idea of deregulation. They don't want, for example, the Tobin tax on
financial transactions. Well, you don't hate to bring Brexit. You love to bring Brexit up. But actually, of course, no. The EU have done nothing about the 2008...
Well, no, at the same time...
They've done nothing about the 2008 financial crisis at all. Because they are exactly in the same sort of position. They want deregulation
all right, well,
too.
Let's put this way. Nobody's done anything about the 2008 financial crisis. We've wasted an awful lot of time talking about other issues, including Brexit.
John, what do you make of the financial system? It does seem like deregulation has really just opened the doors to the criminals. I remember actually hearing about Charlie Richardson, the famous South London gangster. David Southwell wrote about this, and when he was let out of jail after being jailed by Harold Wilson, first job he got was in the City of London.
Well, the only thing I think it might be pertinent to say is that the City of London is a disparate mass. It's not sort of one controlling mind.
Well, thanks very much for being curt there. Time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks very much there to David Banks, Veterans for Britain.